take it away.
Okay, thanks, so first of all, I'd just like to thank the organisers for the invitation and putting together such a wonderful workshop. It's really great to be involved in activities like this, especially in such a really excellent location. Thank you very much for that. So I guess what I'm going to talk about today really is just to give a little bit of perspective from engineering, I guess. So as most of you know, I'm from an engineering department and have a background in maths and engineering. I've just been working in quantum control for about 10 years now, I guess, which I find to be a really exciting area. But when I look at things in quantum information, quantum computing and quantum control, I kind of see things a little bit differently, perhaps. I just wanted to communicate a few of those issues. So the main title of the talk, I guess, is Quantum Feedback Network. And I'll probably won't say a huge amount about that, because today, of course, we'll pick it up in his talk, which is following. And I guess John has given some excellent talks last week on this subject. So, but I do want to give a few examples and share some of the philosophy, I guess. So the perspectives that I want to talk about reflect some of the talks and discussions that we've had in the in the centre that I'm a part of in Australia, which is a centre focused on quantum computation and quantum information. And the issues that are starting to be faced there is how do you go from devices to larger scale systems. And the centre that Gerard is running is faced with similar issues, going from single devices to systems of networks designed to achieve certain objectives. And so I guess that thing of going from devices to systems is really what I want to talk about, I guess. Okay, so here's a perspective on control that comes from a very nice historical article written about 10 years ago. And it's kind of making the point that when we look at the evolution of technology, it sort of takes a while, but eventually things really take off, I guess, just like a wave, you know, building up and then crashing. And so I guess we're starting to see that with quantum technology. I guess we're sort of slowly building up. I don't know at what point things will really take off, but maybe others in the audience will have a better feel for that. But I guess ultimately history will tell us. But I guess the point that I want to make in this slide here is that control is one of the enabling concepts and methodologies that really underlies a lot of the technologies around us. And I guess there's no reason to expect that won't be any different in the quantum context. So in particular, feedback control is really fundamental to the operation of most of the technologies that we have around us in one form or another. Okay. So what is feedback? So I guess last week we had a few discussions and people were puzzling about open loop and closed loop and so on, and that's fair enough because it's not trivial to understand what these things are, and I guess we have a discussion tomorrow which will focus on that. But I just thought I'd do something really simple and I'd just look at the dictionary, right? And this is what the dictionary on my Mac says. And so the feedback is just, I guess, focus on what I've highlighted here. And it's a situation where the sort of modification or control of a process or system is affected by its results or influences or its effects. So when somehow there's some kind of, what I guess, back action or some sort of effect back on itself in some sense. And so usually in control that's understood in terms of a feedback loop. I guess we'll say more about that tomorrow, I guess. But I guess if we think about things, it's probably feedback being used in many different contexts without necessarily realizing it, I guess. Okay, so I just want to reflect on sort of relative state of affairs in terms of maturity of research. This is really quite an important perspective, I guess. So I've got quantum control here and trying to indicate some level of activity, I guess, on the vertical axis. And compare it with some more well-established areas of research. So quantum control, I feel, especially in engineering, is very much in infancy and really needs to be developed and grown. So contrasting it with semiconductors, which is very mature, and of course that's feeding into quantum computing, because there is very mature techniques for developing semiconductors. Quantum optics has been going for quite some time, and it's quite mature. I don't know whether this crossing of the grass is accurate or not, but I sense that there's been a real explosion in activity in the last decade or two relating to quantum ICTs. Quantum ICTs being information control technologies, right? And quantum control has been gradually building up.
I don't understand this. May I ask a question? Yeah. Because you pointed out that one way or the other, control, feedback of control has been implicitly involved in the development of many technologies, including quantum technologies. So I don't understand why you do have a separate line quantum control to begin with. I mean, in quantum optics, you do quantum control. And in quantum ICT, you also do quantum control. So what is it? I thought you were talking about the more general theory, so to say, to describe all these things under a common roof.
That's right.
So why is it in a separate line?
Because it's a separate conceptual framework and sets of tools which haven't really been developed yet.
Can appear in different journals.
It's
a different try.
So activity. I'm not so sure what this means. Is this?
I think it's more than just a different try. I think it refers to a different attitude to quantum control. It's sort of systems independent. It's a more engineering perspective on generic ways of controlling systems that are not specific to quantum optics.
Generally,
activity
would be the number of papers per year or something.
Something like that. It's just getting a rough indication of things. In terms of quantum control, I think if we look at the level of papers being produced, I guess, then there's certainly a lot more historically in the open loop area. And it's only been relatively recently, in the last decade or two, that we've seen a take up in the feedback area. I guess there are many reasons for that, which some of you will know well. Again, if you look at the discipline breakup, most of the activity on feedback control has been in the physics community, with very little in the engineering community yet, I would say. I guess that's another way to say this one, starts to ramp up, I guess. Okay, so all of these things carry with them challenges because, there's language and background differences between engineering and physics. There's lots of challenges in trying to get these things working together, I guess. And meetings like this are really valuable for that purpose, I guess. Okay, just a few other remarks. So when I look at some of the material that is produced in quantum computing and quantum information, one of the things that's really helpful is to be able to look at the kinds of diagrams and the way that people represent their ideas and methods. And so the quantum circuit, of course, is very widely used in quantum computing, and I suspect it's probably not the only diagram that's used, but diagrams can really help shape our thinking, and certainly they themselves emerge from our understanding of what we're trying to do. So if you look at this at that third site, you can see a simple flow from left to right. You don't see any feedback explicitly in that picture. So there may or may not be feedback going on in this particular system, but or a particular implementation of the system, but it's certainly not apparent in looking at the diagram. So when I look at something like that, what I'm reminded of is just a classical combinational diagram. Okay. Where we have the logical bits on the left, the inputs, and the corresponding outputs on the right, just to flow from the left to the right, looks very similar. However, if you look at an undergraduate textbook on digital electronics, you'll also see what are called sequential state machines, finite state machines, where we have feedback explicitly in the system. So this is a very common paradigm for classical digital electronics. And students are taught how to design this state machines by using state diagrams, which again makes very explicit the feedback. But I guess what I'm not seeing is feedback at least being represented directly in the quantum circuit diagrams. So I think Josh and Gerard and other people are starting to look at that kind of issue, and maybe have some comments on that. But feedback is not explicit in that top diagram.
because it's not really a circuit diagram.
It's not really a circuit diagram, that's right. Yeah, so what kind of diagram would it be?
It's a graphical pseudocode for an algorithm.
Right. So are there circuit diagrams in quantum computing?
There should be.
There should be.
I think there tend not to be, though.
They tend not to be, though.
But in the world of analog control, I feel like the SLH diagrams boxes people together are the closest thing you have to circuit diagrams.
Yeah, that's right. So what I'm trying to say is that when an engineer starts to look at the literature on quantum computing and quantum information, it just looks a little bit odd. Representations are not certainly what people are familiar with. And so I kind of sense that there's something sort of missing there at the moment. Okay. The other thing that I see a little bit strange, I guess, is that with the abstraction of the qubit, which they just what I call pseudo dynamical systems, right, where you just have unitaries transferring, giving the quantum computation. But when you look at the absolutely one of the most fundamental units of a classical digital system, namely the flip-flop, to understand how that works, you've got to think about dynamics and feedback, right? The flip-flop is a feedback connection of these exclusive OR gates, right? So to understand how this works, you've got to think about the target diagram. You've got to think about how the changes in input reflect the changes in the output and how they go back and feedback to the inputs and so forward from there. So it's a dynamical process. Okay, so again, I don't see a lot of dynamics and feedback in some of the literature on quantum computing. So why is that? Okay, so just on to, I guess, some higher level issues. So I just want to just make a few remarks about the developments of technology and how engineering processes fit into that. So this is my guess. I think this diagram is supposed to represent going from a fundamental device. So this is a photograph of the first transistor, which is circa 1950, I guess, maybe late 40s, Bell Laboratories. Then eventually, after a few decades, we had integrated circuits that find themselves into products. And today, of course, we have very complex products where we go through a whole very complicated design process involving, I guess, system integration, different levels of hierarchy, component development, mid-level integration development, large-scale integration, and finally, through to the product. So, designing something like an iPhone has a legacy of several decades of very complex design processes operating at different levels of abstraction. So where are we in quantum technology? My guess is we're somewhere down here. Would that be wrong?
Yes.
Probably.
Sure.
At the device level and starting to move forward, right? Would that how you would take things here?
Not much further than that. Yeah.
Sorry?
Not much further along than that.
You know, it could also be that we go this way.
Yeah, that's right.
It's not so clear what that means. This is one development as it happened.
That's right.
Well, the interesting thing about this time frame is where control theory was. Because at that stage, I don't think you even had the Kalman filter, right?
No, the Kalman filter, I think, sort of the middle here, I guess.
Yeah.
Things, if you
that long robust control or anything needed to make.
But again, if I may,
your mobile phone.
May I say something? I'm wondering about, you know, you're missing quantum control elements in the entire setup, conceptual setup of quantum computing, and I don't see it. I mean, if you take quantum error correction, many protocols in quantum information, like teleportation or more generic measurement-based communication. There's explicitly you inquire on the system, you make measurements, you get information, you do something depending on the information. Isn't that? You get feedback from the system and you change your operations. So there is quantum control in that sense in there. It's not missing. Maybe you can do more.
Yeah, I think there are some really fundamental things missing there, right? And those things are never discussed with real-time models, right? And, you know, some of the very basic elements of real control theory have to do with stability, which has everything to do with time delay. Right. And so, you know, there's, there are lots of informal ways to talk about feedback, right? I mean, people talk very informally about feedback in biology, let's say. But you know, the real place where the control theory comes in is in understanding things that have to do with necessary and inherent trade-offs, say, between performance, robustness, and stability. And you know, so that kind of meta layer of analysis, I think, has not been there in the early work on quantum computing.
I think that can be done much more, and it becomes also, you know, an engineering issue, then how you really realize quantum error correction fault or quantum
error. I think a lot depends on how you look at things, and you know, for example, we often use Fourier transforms, right, to analyze the spectral content of signals, right? So, you know, looking at the signal in the time domain, you see a messy graph. You look at it in the frequency domain, you see nice peaks and troughs and so on, so you get a different understanding depending on the coordinate system. And if you have a matrix and you look at it in the wrong coordinates, it'll be just a messy matrix, but the person might be diagonal, right? So looking at things from different perspectives can make a huge difference. Okay, so I've already alluded to some of those points here about engineering design processes, but what I just want to emphasize here is, you know, looking at things at different levels. So you might have some top functional level. In other words, you want to get data securely from point A to point B, right? You might have some specification for that in terms of, you know, the fidelity of the transfer and the amount of intrusion you might be trying to protect against and so on. So at some top level, you've got the purpose of the system encoded in some way. You might have some intermediate level in terms of circuit designs, which may be still fairly abstract. It might be in the form of circuit diagrams like this, right? But then at the lowest level, you've got the hardware. And then how do all these things link together? And so it's doing the right things at the right level that's really important. So doing things at the hardware level is not the same as doing things at the level of the abstract gates, right? So combinational logic like this is just a mathematical abstraction. It's just a way of writing down Boolean algebra, right? But the actual physical hardware, you know, it's a dynamical system. It has analog currents and voltages, okay? And these things are designed with the fact that they have to be included in a bigger network. Okay. The other point is you need appropriate models for appropriate purposes at appropriate levels, right? So here I'm talking about the transistor. So at some fairly low level, you can be writing down equations, a diffusion equation for holes and electrons flowing through the material, right? Or you can have a higher level equation, you know, which is valid in a certain operating condition, which is just the fact that the transistor is just doing a current gain. Just a simple linear relationship between the input current and the output current. So the point is that the models have to be appropriate to the level and simple without being too simple. So the case of an op-amp, operational amplifier, is quite a complicated circuit. Right? Lots of transistors and resistors and other things all connected together. But a very common thing to do is to think about it as some equivalent circuit. Right? And then when you put it into a feedback system, there's a very simple for describing the op-amp that you teach undergraduates. Okay? And so the fact that the op-amp works really depends on the fact that it's in a feedback network. Because the parameters in the device level you know, vary greatly. So the gain of the op-amp without any feedback is widely varying, right? Because of manufacturing issues, right? But when you put it into a feedback loop, the feedback gain is going to be very precisely determined by the values of the external components, just like Hideo was referring to when he said robustness. Okay? That's a very simple example that essentially every engineer would learn about. Okay. So I watch my time, I guess. But, so that kind of leads us, I guess, to circuit theory. So I guess I'm leading on to the quantum networks, I guess. Okay. So I've already talked about equivalent circuits, I guess, when I talk about the op-amp. But in general, you'd like to have a way of simply describing a complex system. But how do you pull all the components together and have a fairly simple, idealized model? The equivalent circuits are really very important, and I'm
explaining the code of outside the ground equivalence theorem. Another point which did this quite different, it did this quite a bit from physics, I guess, is that instead of going from a physical system, working out how the system works, we're going the other way around. We're starting off with some specification. So here is a frequency response diagram for a filter. So you've got a certain cutoff frequency that you'd like to achieve. That's encoded in some mathematical fashion. That will lead to circuit representation. And finally, some practical device, right? And so there's this process of synthesis that really characterizes what engineers do. Right? An important part about engineering, especially if you want to engineer something complex like an iPhone, they've got to be very systematic about it, right? Okay. So all of these things are a standard there for engineers. Okay, so it's with that kind of background in mind that we start to think about what do we do in the quantum context. And so I guess you're all aware of some of the very simple circuit rules from electrical circuit theory. So if we have two resistors, put them in series. That's equivalent to a new resistor whose resistance is just the sum of the two resistances. Okay? So it's a very simple algebraic rule for combining the two resistors together, right? Okay, so we all learned that in high school probably. So now I have a series of quantum systems. I guess this was first looked at by Gardner and Carmichael, I guess, in the early 90s, I think it was. So we'd like to be able to combine together two open systems, define an equivalent open system, okay? So these lines may, for example, some optical fields passing through. And so if we have a parameterization of those two systems with the SLH formalism, then you can write down a parameterization of the equivalent series connection. It's a very simple algebraic tool. And I guess in Hideo's talk, he'll talk more about how these things are being used now. Okay. So I just want to finish the talk in my remaining few minutes with just a few illustrations of using the network theory. And that will lead on to Hideo's talk. We'll give some new developments on the circuit theory and applications in quantum information. So those of you who were here last week, I think, heard some excellent talks by John about the SLH formalism. So this is a formalism for open quantum systems. And so it describes the boson fields as quantum noise, for example. It gives us the evolution in terms of the unitary dynamics of the system and the environment. Once you've got the SLH, stochastic equations, you can work out what the Marshall equation is, and you can work out the filter for the conditional dynamics. We can do lots of things. So just to extend a little bit the formalism that John mentioned last time, which was focused on interconnections mediated by a freely traveling field, as you all know, in physics it's quite common just to have two systems that are just interacting in some direct way. And so this is an augmentation of that. It's a little bit redundant, but I'm including a variable Z here to include an operator of the system, which is going to be part of an interaction Hamiltonian with another system. But just a slight augmentation of the SLH network theory that we saw last week from John. So just to summarize the network constructs, so if we've got two sim systems, we can combine them together into a larger system. So here there's no connections necessarily, but it's really just assembling two pieces together, I guess, in a straightforward way. The series one we've already just talked about, so we have freely traveling fields, say, going from one system to the other. Then we have what we might call the direct connection product, which is got this boson symbol. So this is where we realize the interaction Hamiltonian. Yes?
Could you just say again, what are the Z operators here?
So So I'm trying to describe the interaction between the two systems, G1 and G2. So Z1 is a G1 operator and Z2 is a G2 operator. Yeah. So there's different interaction. So you can see it's redundant. But logically, though, it's making clear the direct couplings. Okay. There's also another type of network construct, which John would have talked about when he was talking about reducing edges. And it's captured by what's called a linear fractional transformation. Okay. This is the most general form of network construct. This is an example from a paper of Howard and Gerard's going back nearly 20 years, I guess. It's a very nice example because it's a feedback system involving direct couplings as well as field mediated couplings. So we've got a pair of cavity motors that are interacting through some sort of optical medium. So it's forming one connection, I guess. Then there's an external freely traveling optical interconnect between the two. And so that can be captured very nicely using this symbolic framework. You can see a process of reduction to an effective circuit from that. You can also make networks using beam splitters, and again, I think John mentioned that last time. So again, you can capture these things fairly straightforwardly. And the final thing that I want to mention before I start is an example from a paper that Hideo was involved with some time ago, I guess, about 10 years ago. And that's a problem of trying to look at a detection problem where you have a quantum system being monitored by Hamiltonian detection, but where they were trying to take into account the imperfections of the measurement device. And so that's a classical dynamical system. So what we're doing is representing the sensor as a classical dynamical system. And I guess I've written that down in the traditional engineering fashion, state-space form. And so in order to work out what the overall quantum filter is, we just simply regard this classical system as being a subsystem in a larger quantum system. Okay? So we can take that classical system, work out the SLH parameters for it. So basically, we're taking the classical variables and identifying them with, say, the position quadrature. Then we're adding in an extra momentum quadrature, which is not being used directly. But nevertheless, it's giving that embedding of a smaller quantum system, a smaller classical system, just identifying that as being a commutative subsystem in a larger quantum system. So once you've got the SLH representation of a classical system, then it's very easy to work out what the cascade connection is going to be. And then once you've got the SLH parameters for the cascade, it's very easy to write down the filter. And here is a diagrammatic representation of that. So this box here is meant to represent the sort of quantum realization of that classical system. Okay, so I think it's really important that quantum technologies are going to inevitably involve both classical dynamics as well as quantum dynamics, and you need to be able to work with them together in a seamless fashion. And so the SLA formula allows that to happen. Okay, thank you.
We have some time for discussion, I think, according to the rules.
Can you say a few more words in this last part? What was classical and what was quantum? If you go back to the...
Okay.
Yeah, that. So if when I look at that, I originally would have thought that one of those variables was actually the density matrix. So it would look like a stochastic master equation. I would say it was quantum. And also the measurement outcome, which is y, which might be regarded as a classical variable. So in your form, in this formalism, what do I regard as quantum? What do I regard as classical? And how is that?
What's in the dotted box is classical. Right, so we have a quantum system, so we have an output field. We do Hamiltonian detection, so that projects you onto a quadrature. Okay. So everything from here onwards is classical. So the simplest example of this is just a low-pass filter, right?
Okay.
So you're losing the high-frequency content in a real device, presumably, right? That's what they were trying to capture, I think. So I've just abstracted this to be a fairly general dynamical system. So W here is the input to that system. Right, so it's the output of the Hamiltonian detector. Okay, So this is the dynamics of that, right? So for example, for a low-pass filter, the dynamics is just a first order linear differential equation, right? Then we have an output, y here, which is corrupted by some additional sensor noise, that's classical noise. And so the final output is just the sum of a signal coming from the filter, the low-pass filter, and a contribution coming from the sensor noise. Okay. So that's classical system. So regarding the sensor noise, for example, we can regard that as being a quadrature of some other quantum field.
I mean, in case it got lost, right, all these QSDs are actually in the Heisenberg picture.
Sure.
So this issue about what's quantum, what's classical, gets buried in what commutes with what. Yeah. So it's not always obvious from the form of the equation which parts of it are treated.
Okay, sure.
But you could formulate it in, it might not be convenient, but if you were formulating it in what might correspond to the Schrodinger picture, you'd have some joint proper Planck description for the classical part and Marshall equation for the quantum part.
Right, you could do that.
But then, I don't know whether you guys look at this, but then you, that's known to lead to inconsistencies. That is non-positivity. You can't just arbitrarily combine.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely, that's right.
And it turns up all over the place, even in trying to understand the interaction between quantum mechanics and gravity.
That's right.
I don't know whether it doesn't arise here because I think the classical system, when there's no sort of coherent interaction between the classical system and quantum system, just sits on top of what comes in.
Yeah, so if you think about the overall quantum model for the whole network, you think about the classical system as being living in a commutative subspace that's invariant under the dynamics. So as you evolve in time, your variables just keep in that subspace. So I'm talking about a subspace of operators in the Heisenberg picture. Right, because the essence of quantum measurement theory, comes from the at least mathematically comes from the spectral theorem, right? So the spectral theorem, looking at self-adjoint operator, that has a continuous spectrum, right? And so when you're choosing a an observable, you're choosing a commutative subspace for your quantum system. That's all we're doing here, except now it's dynamical as well. But to be consistent, you've got to keep inside that dynamical system, and to have everything being consistent in the way that you argued, it's just consistently within the framework of quantum operations.
Yeah, in this sense,
that's captured nicely in the Heisenberg picture here.
Because of the physics.
That's right.
It's a strength. But if you try to do it in an abstract way, you find you have to add a minimum amount of noise to both the classical and the quantum system to preserve positivity.
That's right.
I don't quite understand why, if I were to write down a stochastic master equation, which was a generator for a CP map, how would I end up with problems of positivity? I mean, it's sort of a typical quantum trajectory type formulation.
That would be fine. It's if you start on a more abstract level, so you define a quantum system that depends on classical variables.
Mm-hmm. So you don't derive it from first principle, but you just try to write down.
That's right. Okay. So a good example is in the case of gravity, quantum objects moving in a gravitational field.
Okay.
If you ever have to think about the back action of the quantum objects in a gravitational field, then you run into this. So if they have independent dynamics, then you quickly lose positivity.
But you can also look at feedback loops like this, right?
And feedback is okay.
Feedback is like this fine as well.
The measurement process automatically adds the noise you need.
That's right. So in general, you can imagine, a complicated network involving both classical and quantum systems, all interconnected. So long as the classical part is in the same commutative subspace, then you're okay. So there are rules. I mean, circuit theory in the classical world has rules, right? Kirchhoff's laws, right? So there are rules here as well.
Just on that issue, I would suggest that perhaps the circuit QED people have already taken a strong step in the engineering direction. When they want to build their devices, they typically start with an equivalent circuit.
Yes.
And they quantize that directly.
Yes.
And the fact that that works can either be regarded as profound or trivial, depending on your trajectory.
I just wanted to give an example. We've been doing a coupling of two qubits via virtual transition to another state, okay? And it's some second order quantum mechanics, okay? We can solve for that problem with capacitive network theory. and it gives the same result.
Right.
So why does linear E&M give the same results as quantum mechanics? Kind of neat.
Mm-hmm.
So we can give a little talk on that.
But you probably know better than me what the justification is. It goes back to the early days of superconducting physics of translation.
Okay,
so you can ground it in full QED if you want, but it turns out you don't need to.
My sense is, and I may be wrong in this, but my sense is that for networks, a complicated network like this, the natural way to look at it is in the Heisenberg picture, not the Schrodinger picture. That's because for a complicated interacting system, the state is not a property of each subsystem, it's a state of the whole network. So it's not an intrinsic quantity, right?
Well, that could lead off into all sorts of discussions of quantum Bayesianism, but
yeah.
We can get it back to that.
No.
Are there any other comments, questions?
Okay.